I'd like to thank everyone for calling in. It's 12:15, and we are about to start our briefing call. This is Ori Neer with Americans for Peace Now in Washington. Thank you all for joining us. Our apologies for the short notice. We wanted to make sure that we offer some timely analysis of the latest developments on the Israeli-Palestinian arena. For more analysis, I urge you to read Yossi Alfer's weekly Q&A, which is already posted on our website and will be pushed in our weekly update tomorrow. Before I introduce our guest today and start the briefing call, I would like to recognize Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, which is marked today in Israel. As is the case every year on this day, the country comes to a standstill with a two-minute siren, which sounded this morning, in which everyone stands to pay tribute to the 6 million and to the trauma that the Jewish people had suffered. As the sister organization of Israel's peace movement, Peace Now, Shalom Achshav, we at APN here make a point of recognizing Yom HaShoah. With that, we will make a sharp turn to current affairs, to the state of Israeli-Palestinian relations, U.S. efforts to broker peace between Israelis and Palestinians, and the possible implications of what seems as the failure of the current effort. To help us in analyzing all that, we're hosting Professor Shibli Talhami. Most of you have heard him in the past, either in person or on one of our briefing calls. Shibli is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace Development, Peace and Development at the University of Maryland College Park, and also a non-resident senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. In the past, he also served as a senior advisor to George Mitchell, President Obama's special envoy for Middle East peace in President Obama's first term. He's also an expert on U.S. policy in the Middle East, on public opinion in the Middle East, and on Israeli-Palestinian relations. He's the editor of the best-selling book, The Stakes, America and the Middle East, and the co-author of The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace, which was published last year, and the editor of many other books, which we won't belabor you with here. Professor Talhami will start with some short comments, and then we will have a Q&A. Quick housekeeping comment, all participants are now on mute. To ask a question when we open for Q&A, please dial 5-star, and you can dial that at any time, 5-star. That will alert me to your wanting to ask a question, and I will call on you when we go into Q&A mode. So at any time, you can dial 5-star, and that will let me know that you want to ask a question. Shibli, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much, Uri. Appreciate the opportunity. Allow me to join you all in remembering Yom HaShoah today, one of the darkest moments in modern history, and I think we can all hope never again for anyone around the world. May we never face a similar episode in history. I'd like to start by remembering also a friend who passed away a few weeks ago. Many of you know him, Ambassador Sam Lewis, someone who has contributed so much to the discourse about Middle East peace and was one of the most thoughtful analysts on this issue. And I start with him in part not only because he was a friend and he contributed a lot, but he had commented once something that is good to keep in mind. He said that when it comes to Middle East diplomacy, there are three kinds of dead. There's dead, there's dead and buried, and there's dead, buried, and can't be resurrected. And so if you are trying to look for some good news in the current era of pessimism, we probably are only somewhere between dead and dead and buried. So we have some ways to go before we can declare it dead, buried, and can't be resurrected. Let me just give you why I think that and just put it in some perspective with just a few comments. And I obviously welcome broader questions beyond what I'm going to comment on. But I'll start very quickly with I know what's on everyone's mind, which is the context in which Fatah and Hamas reached an agreement, and also in some ways the context in which Abbas made the statement on the Holocaust yesterday and the PLO's approval of additional the pursuit of additional membership in international organizations, and put it in some perspective, principally through the eyes of the Obama administration's peace strategy in the past few months. And I want to, you know, if I were to summarize the principal strategy of John Kerry, I would say it's really a one-man strategy. Its name is Benjamin Netanyahu. In some ways, Abbas has been, yes, important, but he's a bit of a sideshow. Let me tell you why I think that's the case, and why we find ourselves where we are at the moment in the context of which these additional maneuvers took place. The administration, I think, correctly assumed from the outset that if you get the Israeli government to approve some kind of agreement with the Palestinians along the lines that everyone knows had to be done, something Clinton parameters plus, that the Israeli public would support it. And I think, you know, I conducted an extensive survey among Israelis and Palestinians in December that I shared with the administration, where it was clear that a majority of Israelis would support a pretty bold plan that would include sharing Jerusalem, and it would even more so, up to 60% of Israel would support it if the Palestinians were also to support it. And so in that sense, the administration's strategy has been from the beginning assuming that, number one, they need to have an Israeli government approval for this. But they also understood that within the Israeli government, there are members who would never accept this. So ultimately, it was really a strategy to persuade the prime minister, give him all of the things that he wants in some ways that they can provide to get to yes from him. And their assumption has been if once he personally accepts it, he can obviously revise his coalition to accommodate that. He can get it through the Israeli public. Now, the same wasn't, of course, exactly true on the Palestinian side, although it was, some of it was true, meaning their assumption had been that with Abbas, yes, you need to get him to support it, but he was in a much weaker position to deliver. Part of it is public opinion. Yes, public opinion, according to our poll, for example, in December, what a plurality would support a plan along the lines that's been talked about, but only a plurality was like 40-some percent in the first round, both in the West Bank and Gaza. That number goes up to 60% if the Israelis accept it, but that's a long way to go, particularly given the Palestinians' mistrust and Israelis' mistrust, mutual mistrust about what the others intends to do and so forth. So public opinion, therefore, was a factor that had to be cultivated on the Palestinian side. It can't be just dismissed because Abbas himself is in a weaker state. Second, they assume that in order to get Abbas to move and to have the backbone to support what will inevitably be a compromise agreement, you're going to have Arab public Arab leader support and principally really Saudi support, because obviously the Arab world is going through much right now, and if you look at the key players, you need Saudi Arabia, and obviously you get the GCC pretty much with that, and of course Jordan would be supportive, perhaps Morocco, but principally they needed the King of Saudi Arabia, work on him very much, obviously with Kerry going there and meeting with him, and then the president, the Egyptians, who obviously are central as well, particularly because of Gaza and Hamas. So when you look at all that picture, there was a lot more to do with the Arab sides to sort of work on Abu Mazen. It wasn't an Abu Mazen personal strategy as much as it was giving him enough of a support network to make it happen. When it came to Hamas, the administration strategy was really kind of the standing American strategy, which is that we don't have to deal with them now. We can have Abu Mazen negotiate the agreement, and then at some point they will either have to be brought in, or at a minimum, if you take the agreement to a referendum, then you're going to have probably support from the Palestinians, and therefore Hamas will find itself in a bind. Either they will have to join or they'll be isolated. That was kind of the thinking that the administration had, and up to a point, I think the Palestinian Authority had. And I would add to this that in the first Obama administration, when I was senior advisor with Martin Indyk of Special Envoy George Mitchell, it was clear that the administration's strategy, while it rejected the upfront reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas, which I had recommended in an article with Steve Cook in the CFR Brookings article at the beginning of the Obama administration, that they actually believed that at some point Hamas would have to be brought in, but after it is weakened. So this is not a new thing that at some, you know, in American thinking that at some point you have to find a way to engage Hamas, obviously, if they meet certain conditions, but clearly everyone understood that in order to implement an agreement on the scale that was being talked about, you're going to have to find a way to bring them into the tent. Now, what happened over the past few weeks is, the Abu Mazen has lost a lot of that network of support. Even the Saudis and the Egyptians and the Arab League had been very frustrated both with the lack of advanced talk about extending the talks beyond the April deadline, the announcement about building settlements in Jerusalem, the prisoner issue. And you saw that instead of the Arab League and the Saudis being a positive, meaning a pressure point on Abu Mazen, they were actually issuing statements to the contrary and supporting him to hold firm on those issues. We found the same thing in terms of public opinion. When you look at public opinion, while a lot of people were in principle supportive of an agreement, only 11% of Palestinians thought an agreement was possible. So people were obviously betting that an agreement wasn't going to happen. And so with all of that, and facing the prospect that he's going to have to extend the talks because an agreement wasn't in hand and he has nothing to deliver, I think Abu Mazen did two things that he thought would strengthen his hand, not only vis-a-vis Netanyahu, but more importantly vis-a-vis his constituency. One of them was doing that initial move of joining about a dozen international organizations. And obviously the second move was his reconciliation with Hamas. I think that, I wouldn't take this too far about the agreement with Hamas. We've seen it many, many times before. We don't really know how it's going to work out, whether it's going to work out. There's a lot of opposition to it internally within each organization. It serves both interests in the short term, but we'll see. You've got a few weeks to figure out whether you can have a unity government of any kind, and so I think he's using it as a lever point. But here's the odd thing: is that people think of this moment as a moment of Abbas weakness, and therefore maneuvering to shore up his domestic support. Partly that's true, of course, and he's been able to do that in some ways through these moves. But what people also are ignoring is that Hamas is even weaker than he is. That actually one reason why Hamas was pretty much willing to give him everything he asked for in joining so far in this agreement is that they're even weaker. And they're weaker in large part because they lost their regional network of support that looked so promising, just a year ago when they had the Muslim Brotherhood in power in Egypt, the support of Qatar, the support of Turkey. Both of these countries are kind of now on the defensive, and obviously Egypt is a completely different environment with the pressure on them from this current military government, far stronger even than it was in the Mubarak era. So they're on the defensive, they didn't have options. They're eager to find a way in. So he actually, Abu Mazen, exploited it. And with all of that, I think it, in fact, in many ways, if he really wants to extend the talks beyond, tomorrow's deadline, and if the U.S. finds a way to engage the Israelis again, he is in a far better position to do so with justification within his own public than he was a few weeks ago. So this is the interesting thing is we obviously don't know where this is going to go from here. But in many ways, if there's going to be a renewal of negotiation extension beyond the April 29th, put himself in a much better position to say yes than he was a few weeks ago. I'll end with that, and then I'll open it for questions.
Thank you, Shibley. In order to ask a question again, what you do is you dial five star. That will alert me that you want to ask a question. I will then unmute you. You will hear a message saying that you've been unmuted, and you'll be able to ask a question. Our first question comes from David Abraham.
Yes, good afternoon. So I was very struck by what seemed to be the utter lack of preparation on part for the announcement of the reconciliation agreement. As you indicated, there's been a lot of talk about it over the years. It's an essential prerequisite to any agreement that all Palestinians be engaged with it. The United States has tolerated people in Bibi's government who are at least as explicitly against an agreement as Hamas. Why the cluelessness in the response, which wound up in turn being an endorsement of the Bibi position, either you negotiate with Hamas or you negotiate with us? How did the U.S. fall into this position, if not willingly?
It's a good question, and I can speculate a little bit. You know, I haven't talked to people within the administration since the reconciliation. But I'll tell you what the mindset is. The mindset is that, all these talks are really kind of in some ways intended to just address public opinion, but there was such profound disagreement that any meaningful agreement is not likely. And I think everyone read pretty carefully the sentiment within Fatah itself, which has been very much reluctant to reconcile with Hamas in any meaningful way. So the Palestinian, the absence of reconciliation wasn't just simply a function of pressure or opposition from the U.S., Israel, and to some extent Egypt, but really that even within Fatah itself there's been a very, very strong opposition to it. And so if those maneuvers are going on, the talks have been going on for years, as you know, dating back to the Mubarak era when Omar Suleiman used to negotiate and had reached certain agreements that never were fully implemented. So I think the assumption was that they can do something, but it wouldn't be particularly meaningful. We don't even know that it's going to be particularly meaningful at this point. I think it generated a lot of attention in part because it comes at a moment when people thought, well, Abu Mazen doesn't have any options, and he's trying to, point out that he has some options and put them out on the table. And frankly, when you look at it from the Israeli point of view, I think the Netanyahu reaction was a bit puzzling, not because, one can't understand his anger with Hamas. Obviously, that's clear. But, I mean, there are two things here that go on. On the one hand, you argue that the Palestinians are divided, they can't make a deal. Suddenly, they're moving in a particular direction, and Abu Mazen is saying, I'll still be the representative of the negotiations. We'll still take a position that will recognize Israel and oppose the terrorism. Wait and see to see whether, in fact, Hamas changes or conforms or accepts the conditions. At some point, as we get closer to negotiate to an end, everyone has an interest in bringing them under the tent as long as it's accepting the norms, the prevailing norms for an agreement. So wait and see. That's number one. Number two, when you are in a coalition of choice, I mean, let's not forget that Netanyahu is in a coalition of choice, not a coalition of necessity, whose many members of which are profoundly opposed to the kind of agreement we're talking about and say so day in and day out. It's very hard to take him at his word when he says, now they're joining with Hamas and so forth. And third, if you are going to focus principally on the message that this sends, saying, well, he can't be serious about peace if he's doing this with Hamas, well,
then how could people think that he can be serious about peace when 14,000 units have been built since the beginning of negotiations? So there is a little tension here that we can't play into this, mode of saying, the reason why we are where we are is because the Palestinians had this agreement. I think not, personally. Whether or not it's a good idea is another story. But I don't think that's really the core of the problem right now.
And I think this is Ori from Washington. Just to strengthen your point, I think it's worthwhile to remind everyone that Israel is negotiating with the PLO. It's not negotiating with the PA, and certainly not with the Palestinian government, which will not include Hamas because it will be a technocrat government. But even if it did, Israel's negotiating partner is the PLO headed by Mahmoud Abbas.
Obviously the government that or whoever is negotiating and whatever agreement is signed is going to have to accept Israel and, renounce terrorism against Israel and do all of that. No Israeli government is ever going to accept anything less than that. So it's not, like this is passing judgment on the nature of an agreement or the nature of the party that's negotiating with Israel.
Thanks. Our next question comes from Kathleen Paradis.
Hi, Shibley.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you doing?
I'm good. You noted, and it's certainly an irony, that Abbas has strengthened his hand by doing the two things that Israel and the U.S. most wanted him not to do, by signing on to some international agreements and by at least taking this little step toward a reconciliation with Hamas. In light of the fact that that strengthens his hand against Israel, what does that tell Fatah it should be doing going forward in order to further strengthen its hand?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's, quote, strengthens his hand against Israel per se. I think it strengthens his hand in getting public support for renewal of negotiations. So in that sense, it actually is quite the opposite. It's not getting necessarily into a mode of confrontation. There's a lot of pressure on him from the administration to continue the negotiations beyond April 29. This is something that the Netanyahu government absolutely wanted. The Palestinians did not. They saw it as a waste of time because obviously they're on the receiving end of the change on the ground that goes against them. And any more time is seen to favor Israel and make the Palestinian state less likely, and that's one reason we don't want to play into it. So clearly his public wasn't supportive of that. Many around him, including within Fatah, weren't supportive of that. And that's still what the administration wants. The administration hasn't given up on cultivating him. They've been meeting with them constantly. In some ways, the Palestinian Authority has been, has a very good working relationship with Secretary of State and the administration, and they think that they want to play. They don't want to say out. They understand that ultimately they don't really have a unilateral solution. They might be able to hurt the Israelis, but they can't solve it on their own, and vice versa. So I think he put himself not so much in a stronger position against Israel per se, as much as he put himself in a better position to say yes for moving forward, if that's what's on the table. Now, down the road, obviously, if there is no negotiation, clearly it's a lot that could come. I think if you look at it from the Israeli point of view, what would happen, if there's no renewal of negotiations and there's a declaration of failure? I think that you're going to have a lot of the people, including probably many on this call, who have invested so much on the two-state solution, which I still support, who are going to conclude probably that it's no longer possible. If this administration, with all that it's put on the table, couldn't do it, aren't we deluding ourselves? Isn't this a semi-permanent situation? Can we leave with the immorality of the occupation, particularly if it translates in our minds into a semi-permanent situation? Because I think, frankly, the two-state solution has not only been a kind of solution for Israelis and Palestinians as a pragmatic way out of their conflict, it has been a psychological solution for many around the world, including, you know, Arabs and Jews and others who care about this issue, as a psychological way out of their immediate dilemma, which is they understand the injustice and the wrongs of being in a situation of occupation, but it is assumed to be, when you assume it to be temporary on the way out, you put all your focus on how you get out of there. And the two-state solution was a psychological solution for most to resolve the dissonance, particularly for many people who wanted to support Israel and at the same time wanted to have a moral position, a liberal position, an accommodating position of human rights. And so if you take that out, I think you're going to have a problem. And I did a poll here in the U.S. A couple of months ago that I released in foreignpolicy.com, where I asked the American public, what if you had, if the two-state solution is no longer an option, what would you support? Continuation of the status quo, annexation of the West Bank without equal citizenship, or one state with equal citizenship? Of those who support the two-state solution, I had two-thirds say they would then support a one-state solution with equal citizenship, including 52% of those who identified themselves as pro-Israel, because that's an issue with that. And by the way, when you ask the public, if you have to choose between Jewishness and democracy, what would you choose? You had, again, more than two-thirds of the American public say they would choose democracy over Jewishness. So that's the kind of thing that we're going to likely see psychologically that will translate itself, obviously, internationally in terms of, yes, the option for the Palestinian Authority would be to highlight all these issues that relating to things that the international community considers illegal, whether they're settlements or house demolitions, the sort of things that they will then have recourse to take into international organization, particularly International Criminal Court, if in fact the Palestinians seek membership there, which I think they probably would if the peace process is not moving.
I wonder what would happen if you polled the people on this phone those same three choices that you just laid out.
Well, I think here's the thing. The easiest thing for us to do is to pretend. I mean, if we wake up in the morning and say it looks like the two-state solution isn't going to happen, I think that psychologically we rationalize it and say it's still going to happen. I can't give up on it, in part because mm-hmm. we just can't live with the dissonance. And I think that rationalization is immoral. At some point, you're going to have to call it the way it is. And I think that's why I believe that a lot of people are reaching that point where you look yourself in the mirror and say, I know I'm just still saying it's possible, but is it really? And am I escaping moral responsibility? Am I escaping making the tough choices I have to make? And I think each one of us, I think, is going to be looking at that mirror.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thanks. Our next question will come from Victor Kovner, who, just like Kathleen Paradis, is an APN board member. Go ahead, Victor.
Sure. Thank you for being available, and so good to hear from you. Given the weakness of Abbas and questions about his ability to close, how critical would the release of Marwan Barghouti be to strengthen Abbas's hand, make his ability to close and therefore be more credible to the Israelis? And is there anything that can be done that might encourage that development?
Well, you know, I obviously, releasing Barghouti would be psychological plus across the board in the Palestinian areas. He's a popular man who seemed to have paid a heavy price and has a lot of support within the younger members of Fatah. But having said that, I don't think that his release would be transformative. I think in part because while Abu Mazen wants to claim that he was behind his release and therefore, gain from it, He also see him, may see him in the short term as a potential competitor. And they don't want to enter into that game at this point. This is too, you know, unless there's a failure of negotiations, which Fatah is rebuilding, they don't want to face that situation at this point. And so I don't think in and of itself it would be, you know, a game changer. I think the release of prisoners, period, is going to be important, in part because, of course, that's what Israel had committed to from the outset, but in part because the prisoner issue, I think a lot of people in the U.S. don't understand how profoundly important it is among Palestinians, because you're talking about so many Palestinians had family members. It's, in fact, very hard to find a family across the Palestinian society that didn't have a relative or a distant relative who had served in prison. And you still have thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons, some of them dating back for decades. So so I think that prisoner issue broadly is important itself, and clearly implementing what was agreed is going to be central. I'm not sure that Barghouti's release itself, while important, that would be transformative.
But doesn't Abbas want to use or get the benefit of Barghouti in the election that he now announces is coming up soon?
He would, but you know, the main thing right now isn't that issue. I mean, Palestinian public principally wants to see real resolution of the issues they care about. Settlement remains the biggest issue in their minds. I mean, if you get a settlement freeze tomorrow, I don't care, even the prisoner issue will become a side issue at once. I mean, I think what's killing everything is the settlement issue. That's the one that is driving people, you know, into believing that that's why they want renewal, because they see it as buying time for more change on the ground. And it's very important. I mean, you know, when you look at the Palestinians and their limits, and, you know, they make mistakes, and there are, you know, and they have divisions, and they have their own problems. But they're the weaker party, and they're under occupation. And then here's the thing. We all have an interest in not making this conflict a violent one. We all want a peaceful end to this conflict. But you do know that, you know, whatever we want or whatever is moral, the options are limited, violence may become inevitable. And so, therefore, even the maneuvers that we seem to think are inappropriate, whether they are going to international organizations or trying to bring Hamas in and reduce the pressure for militarization, that's not a bad thing if you want to avoid violence. And so we need to keep in mind that, you know, the status quo is not tenable, and there are costs to be paid, and that whatever the diplomatic options or political options or political maneuvering, they're far better than having the pressure come towards militarization.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Victor. I will try to accommodate as many people as I can. We have more participants on this call than I can ever remember, so it's a bit of a challenge, but I will try to accommodate as many as possible. Next question comes from Michael Thomas here in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Ori. One real quick question, and then a second. Why the reconciliation deal days before April 29th? Wouldn't it have been strategically advantageous to wait until the 29th, assuming that at that point there is no deal satisfactory to the Palestinians to extend the talks?
Well, I can't really tell you that I know, why the timing took place when it did. But here's my speculation. My speculation is that the Palestinians wanted to keep the extension of the talks an open possibility before April 29th, but by April 29th. They believe that, Abu Mazen undoubtedly was trying to find every possible way to garner public support for extending the negotiations, because that he saw that as his best option. And that goes back to the time when he visited here at the White House and met with President Obama. I actually met with him as well when he was here. And so it's clear that, you know, that was his instinct. And I think that if that's the case, then, you know, he was bound to face criticism if, in fact, the U.S. and the Israelis have found a way to get the, you know, moving forward under certain conditions. And then he's going to be under a lot of criticism for accepting to extend the negotiations. A lot of opposition to the extension of the negotiations, seen as a waste of time. So bringing Hamas in reduced the amount of possible opposition to him. And it made it more likely for him to see yes. That's my own speculation about it. I don't know that for sure, but I think it just makes sense if this is what he wanted to position himself to say yes. And then he wanted to position himself in case there is no extension the morning after, you know, he's already Hamas. He doesn't want to enter into negotiations with Hamas after Hamas is strengthened, because if there is failure and he has no option, he goes back to talk to Hamas. Hamas is going to be in a stronger position because he's coming to them after he has failed. He doesn't want to be in that position either.
And let me ask this. Netanyahu has said that he won't deal with a government supported by Hamas. And that, of course, doesn't condition the position on what role Hamas plays or what the charter of this government is, what the agreements are. It says if it's supported by Hamas, he won't deal with it. There's been criticism coming out of the government of Israel of the U.S. reaction to the reconciliation effort as not being strong enough. So let's assume, maybe counterfactual, but let's assume that a government is formed that confirms Abbas's position as a negotiator in compliance with the three quartet conditions and no Hamas position in any critical roles in the government. And, of course, as we've noted, it's the PLO that's doing the negotiating anyway. Is there a possibility, then, that the U.S. government would split with the government of Israel on the need to go forward? And if it wouldn't split with the government of Israel on the need to go forward under those conditions, what does it tell you about really turning away from the process and the prospects in any conceivable near future for an agreement?
Well, you know, I think with Netanyahu, you know, obviously some of his posture is genuine, because I think many members of his you know, his own coalition are allergic to even the thought that Hamas may be acquiescing in whatever government, even if they don't have members in that government, for sure. But a lot of it is also tactical. This is one that he can, you know, gain public opinion on. He can gain leverage, perhaps with other supporters of Israel, he would think. And therefore, it gives him a bit of leverage. If he wants to negotiate renewal and negotiations, the U.S. Is going to have to put some more on the table. So, I wouldn't, as I said about this dead and buried and can't be resurrected. I would say this is on the level of the dead, not on even the level of the dead and buried. So I wouldn't say that he's, you know, that this is necessarily profound. But let's say that ultimately there is a real break between Israel and the U.S. And I think those of us who live in Washington. Know that there is kind of a profoundly changed environment, in part because, you know, the Palestinians aren't perfect, but you're not going to get anything better than what they have given what they're under occupation. And if you've got an administration that is putting all the priorities aside and saying, I care enough to want to make this happen in an environment where they're even getting criticism for doing this, and they can't succeed, then something is wrong. And I think when you go into a spirit and you continue to build settlements even as you're, you know, approaching a political resolution that is ultimately supposed to dismantle settlements, something is wrong. And I think a lot of people are really, I think, angry in the American political mainstream, particularly around this administration. So it's not about supporting Israeli security, but you can feel that there is that the old kind of pointing finger just is not working like it used to. You know, Israel has a lot of support and will continue to have a lot of support in American mainstream. But there's even a division, and you can see it in the polling, between Democrats and Republicans on this. In my polling, you know, where I do the breakdown, you know, there's a shift in the Democratic Party toward placing the weight of the position on the Israel-Palestine on human rights and moral issues in international law, not on the old division, I'm pro-Israel and I'm pro-Palestinian. In the Republican Party, it's very different. So you got the kind of support, but not the kind of support that is in harmony with the mainstream, the American Jewish community. So, but there is here in the elites around this administration, there's no question there is a, one senses this anger and frustration and in a way, you know, feeling that it's about time to do something else. So yes, I think you can imagine a situation where the administration says, I'm not going to, place the same effort anymore. So the question is, what would they then do? I mean, that's really the big question. And as you know, there are really a variety of things that they can do. One is quote, walk away from it. I think that's not realistic. I think it's not realistic because instantly you can have, somebody bringing up to the UN a resolution condemning Israel or even more declaring settlements illegal. And the U.S. is going to be forced to either veto it or acquiesce in it. And either way, it means the U.S. is going to be directly involved and it's going to have to either answer to the international community and the Middle East or answer to domestic constituencies. So there's no real walking away from it. So the real options are going to be more, does then the administration put its own plan on the table, like Bill Clinton, and make it broad enough that's maybe a little bit more specific than Bill Clinton, but not too specific, and hope that this will generate some, if not now, but some opportunities down the road. The second is to put a much more specific plan that is much more detailed, particularly on final status issues. And third, whether or not they want to take it to the Security Council, which in this environment, particularly with the competition with Russia, is not likely to work, in part because I think it just ceases to be an American plan once you take it there, and you're going to have all kinds of bickering about the terms. And how would that, either one of these, any of these steps, how would any of these steps in any way help preserve the two-state solution, which remains the American foreign policy goal? In what way can you do something, whether it's an American unilateral something or an international something, that makes it, that extends the life of a two-state solution? And that's going to be the real thing that they're going to. So I don't think it's going to be necessarily in a direct way confrontation with Israel pertaining to things like aid, as much as it's going to be, will then the administration do its own thing in a way that will alienate the Israelis?
Thank you. Shibley, with your permission, I'm going to take two questions at a time now, and we'll try to sort of expedite the procedure that way. So the first one will come from Frank Bamberger, and the second one will come from Mr. Saltis. I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly.
Ori Saltis, same name as yours, Ori.
Oh, okay, thanks. So, Frank, you go first, please.
Right, Shibley, going back to what you said at the beginning of our call about Hamas, I understood you to say that Hamas would have to accept Israel. Can't Hamas, without saying that they will accept any of the three conditions, just say, if the Palestinian population agrees in a referendum with a settlement, then we will go along.
Okay, and Uri here in Washington?
Sure. My question was going back to Saudi Arabia. It wasn't that long ago that there were a number of us talking about the Saudis and the Israelis becoming necessarily closer because of a common fear of Iran, particularly once the Obama administration began negotiations with Iran. So is there not still some hope that the Saudis could give the kind of support you talked about for the whole process that would give Abu Mazen more support? I mean, to say nothing of Netanyahu, but I guess that's a different story.
Well, let me start with the Hamas question very quickly. You know, they can do what they can. You know, they've been obviously trying to keep their official position close to the chest, but they've been alluding to, you know, changes, and particularly in talking with the Palestinian Authority. But the bottom line is, whatever their real position is, one can speculate on this. Whatever it is, there isn't Palestinian public opinion, and there is a, you know, the Israelis are negotiating not with Hamas, but with a Palestinian, with the PLO and the Palestinian Authority. And wherever agreement is going to be reached, it's going to be an agreement that's going to bind the Palestinians, whoever they are and whoever represents them, to its terms, and those terms are going to be inevitably and obviously the recognition of Israel within the 67 boundaries and renunciation of violence and further claims. And anyone who wants to be part of the deal is going to have to be part of it, and particularly if it has support. So in some ways, I think the whole issue about Hamas is not the central issue, and it's very important to have them, have the opportunity to change the position as you move forward. So I don't see that as the main problem in the short term. It's a challenge, but I don't see it as the main problem in the short term. On the Saudi Arabia and Iran, yes, I think isn't it, that there is a strategic overlap between not only Saudi Arabia, but really the GCC states combined, particularly the UAE and Saudi Arabia on Iran, and they clearly fear Iran. Even if you have a nuclear agreement, in fact, the Saudis arguably would fear Iran even more if there is a nuclear agreement that prevents them from having nuclear weapons, but ultimately it gives them more economic and political clout because their fears are more related to meddling in their own affairs and influencing the public opinion and playing a role in the Gulf politically in a way that competes with them. So the worry isn't so much about the nuclear issue. In that sense, we all know that, there have been coordinations between them and some of the Gulf states behind the scenes.
Right.
It is noteworthy that some of the meetings that were being conducted with Israelis directly were conducted by Prince Bandar, who was the head of intelligence until recently, while he was working on the Syria issue, and he was obviously stationed, often would come and stay in Jordan, and was a meeting behind the scenes with Israelis and on coordinating on those issues. It's noteworthy that he has been removed from his position, principally perhaps because of health. He apparently asked for it, but nonetheless, whether or not there's a changed environment, it's hard to know, and the Saudis and GCC states have been in anticipation of something coming out of the negotiations with Iran. They have been kind of now hedging the bets in terms of maybe not alienating Iran too much. So there is an opportunity, but that opportunity can't be exaggerated. It's not so much that for confrontation with Iran, the Saudis are going to forget about the Palestine question or the Jerusalem issue. And people forget that when George W. Bush came to office and he was very close to Saudis, he was interpreting their posture to be one of only rhetorical commitment to the Palestinian question, and he ignored it completely. And ultimately, by June of the first year, 2001, the posture of then Crown Prince Abdullah, who's now the King of Saudi Arabia, of turning down Bush's request to meet with him and sending him a nasty letter saying, "I'm not doing it because of your policy on the Palestine question," that led to a whole reexamination of American policy in the region just before 9/11. And obviously all of that changed. It just tells you that whatever you say about the Saudis, yes, they're first motivated by the survival, and they worry about their neighborhood, and they have some overlapping interests with the Israelis, but they really do care about the Palestine question, and they care about the terms of an agreement, and they care about the Jerusalem issue, and they will not just be a rubber stamp, I think, and that's why the administration has been working on them on this issue.
Thanks.
Do you have time for two more quick ones?
Yes, I'd be
or
happy to do
I think? Okay, great. So our next question will come from Doug. Doug is in area code 424. Go ahead, please. If you're still with us, you've been waiting patiently for a long time.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Sure.
I read a story this morning, Uri, that John Kerry told the Trilateral Commission on Friday that he was considering releasing his own peace plan and telling both sides to take it or leave it. And I'm wondering whether you believe that this is something that Secretary Kerry should be encouraged to do.
Okay, you want to take another question,
yeah,
or should I deal with that?
No, just go ahead with that. Thanks.
Okay, you know, obviously, you know, if there is an American plan, it's not going to be John Kerry's plan. It's going to be Barack Obama's plan. This is way over his pay grade, because this is just politically so consequential that that the Obama, you know, Obama himself has to have a buy-in, as we know, on this big issue. And obviously, this has been on the table. This is not a secret. You know, from the inside and outside, people have been proposing this to the administration. It's certainly one of the options they have, and something that may be you know, worth pursuing. But I personally think that if you're going to put a plan, number one, it has to be specific. If you have a model plan along the Clinton parameters, and people both will be likely turn it down, it wouldn't move you know, the needle at all. You're going to have a negative reaction, and ultimately, if you don't have a follow through, how is that going to preserve the status quo, the possibility of a two-state solution, you know, unless you have teeth and you say, if you don't accept this, then here's what we're going to do, which I don't hear anybody articulating. I don't see how it can work. Number two, in order to give teeth to such a plan, taking into account the complexity of our own politics, it would really have to be an international plan, meaning it had to be a Security Council plan. But if you take a plan like that, as I said earlier, to the Security Council, the problem is it ceases to be an American plan and you lose control of it. And that's something that, you know, every administration is mindful of. But they have a third option, an option that is in a way more straightforward, which is not per se one that has to do with a detailed plan, because that's complicated. If you're going to deal with preserving the status, the possibility of two states, one option you have is actually, you know, not vetoing a resolution at the Security Council when it comes up on a settlement issue and with establishing its illegality and therefore opening up new consequences through international mechanisms. That would have far more consequence, I think. And it would change the environment dramatically and take it out of the American political process in many ways, because it becomes an international issue that no one can ignore. So they have, you know, they have other options. None of them are great, but they're going to be forced to do something, because I think walking away is not a real option, as I said. It's sort of theoretical, but in when you translate it into the real world, before you know it, the U.S. is going to have to make some tough decisions.
So, Shipley, if you had a closed meeting with President Obama and Secretary Kerry now, what would be your recommendation? What would, if they asked you, you know, what would be the best thing to do now? What would you tell them?
The first thing I would do is I would say revive the negotiations and finally put a plan, not a public plan, but put a plan to both of them, take it or leave it, privately, and try to persuade them to take it and talk about the cost before you take it publicly. So what I would do is you know, the whole idea of renewal and negotiations was that the U.S. isn't really negotiating every term. The U.S. is ultimately listening to each side to see what are the limits on each one of the specific issues. But here's the problem. When you negotiate issue by issue, there's no compromise. We find that in our simulation in December, when you ask Israelis, are you prepared to compromise on Jerusalem? Of course, the majority is going to say no. If you ask them, are you prepared to compromise on borders, you have the same thing. But when you give them a package and say, here's the compromise on Jerusalem, but here's what the Palestinians are going to have to do on refugees, and here's what this, you are basically compromise across issues, the environment changes. And if you think that the Palestinians and the Israelis on their own will voluntarily tell you what their red lines are, it's silly. They'll never do that because it's always in negotiations. And it's even more so when you enter the negotiations thinking they're going to fail. If you enter 4% of Israelis in December said they think negotiations will fail, 11% of the Palestinians. And if you have even the political leadership think maybe there's 20% chance but 80% chance of failure, you're very stupid to make specific compromises on issues that then would tie your hands down the road. So, the time has come for the administration within the negotiations to put its own detailed framework on the table and try to sell it to them. And if they don't buy it, then consider going unilateral. And my own view would be going unilateral is not necessarily putting the plan on the table, or if you want to put a plan on the table, it has to be coupled with something meaningful on those things that are seen to be most detrimental to state solution. There are two things. The one is we don't want violence, and so therefore we have to make sure that no one will accept violence. But number two, we don't accept settlements because those are the things that are really crippling the negotiation, the possibilities. And so therefore you have to encode that not simply as something unhelpful or statement, but you have to, and it's not going to come out of our political process where we can really put teeth into it. It has to be that you're going to have to encode it in the international, particularly UN Security Council, to preempt the possibility that you're going to have developments on the ground that will render all diplomacy, useless down the road.
Thank you so much, Professor Tohami. Thank you for joining us. This concludes our briefing call. There will be more soon, so follow us and we will announce them as they are scheduled. A recording of this call will be available on our website shortly. And thank you very much all for joining us. Thank you.
Thanks for
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.